as soon as possible, but I was beat and likely to make mistakes. With all the bad guys running around town, there was no sense in going out there into the dark, exhausted and unprepared. I'd wait for the potions to be ready and Bob to come back from his mission, at least. Sunlight would cut down on the risk as well, since Red Court vampires got incinerated by it, and I doubted these Denarian fruitcakes would get along with it either. Thus prioritized, I checked my notes and started putting together a couple of potions that would offer me a few hours of protection from the narcotic venom of the Red Court. The potions were simple ones. Brewing any kind of potion required a base liquid, and then several other ingredients meant to bind the magic put into the potion to the desired effect. One ingredient was linked to each of the five senses, then one to the mind, and one to the spirit. In this case, I wanted something that would offset the venomous saliva of the Red Court vampires, a narcotic that rendered those exposed to it passively euphoric. I needed a potion that would ruin the pleasurable sensations of the poison. I used stale coffee as my base ingredient. To that I added hairs from a skunk for scent, a small square of sandpaper for touch. I tossed in a small photo of meatloaf cut from a magazine for sight. A rooster's crow I'd stored in a small quartz crystal went in for hearing, and a powdered aspirin for taste. I cut the Surgeon General's warning label from a pack of cigarettes and chopped it fine to add in for the mind, and then lit a stick of the incense I sometimes used while meditating and wafted some of the smoke into the two bottles for the spirit. Once the potions were bubbling over a burner, I drew in my wearied will and released power into the mixes, suffusing them with energy. They fizzed and frothed with gratifying enthusiasm. I let them simmer for a while, then took them from the fire and emptied them into a pair of small sports drink bottles. After that, I slumped on a stool and waited for Bob to come home. I must have nodded off, because when my phone rang, I jerked myself up straight and nearly fell off my stool. I clambered up the ladder and picked up the phone. "Dresden."
"House,"
said a weather-beaten voice on the other end. Ebenezer McCoy, a sometime teacher of mine, sounded businesslike.
"Did it wake you up?"
"No, sir," I said. "I was up anyway, working on a case."
"You sound tired as a coal mine mule."
"Been up all night."
"Uh-huh," Ebenezer said. "House, I just called to let you know not to worry about this duel nonsense. We're gonna slap it down."
By we, Ebenezer meant the senior council members. Seven of the most experienced wizards on the White Council held positions of particular authority, especially during times of crisis, when quick decisions were needed. Ebenezer had turned down his chance at a seat on the senior council for nearly 50 years. He took it only recently to block a potentially fatal political attack directed against yours truly by some of the more conservative, read fanatic, members of the White Council.
"Slap it down? No, don't do that."
"What?" Ebenezer said.
"You want to fight this duel? Did you fall and hit your head, boy?"
I rubbed at my eyes.
"Tell me about it. I'll work out something to give me a shot at winning."
"Sounds like your wagon's already pretty full to be letting this vampire push you."
"He knew where to push," I said. "Ortega brought a bunch of goons into town. Vampires and straight hitmen, too. He says that if I don't face him, he's going to have a bunch of people I know killed." Ebenezer spat something in what I presumed was Gaelic.
"You'd better tell me what happened, then."
I told Ebenezer all about my encounter with Ortega.
"Oh, and a contact of mine says that the Red Court is divided over the issue. There are lots of them who don't want the war to end."
"Of course they don't," Ebenezer said. "That fool of a Merlin won't let us take the offensive. He thinks his fancy wards will make them give up."
"How are they working out?" I asked.
"Well enough for now," Ebenezer admitted. "One major attack has been pushed back by the wards. No more council members have been killed in attacks on their homes, though the Red Court's allies are putting pressure on ours, and a few wardens have died on intelligence-gathering missions. But it isn't going to last. You can't win a war sitting behind a wall and hoping the enemy decides to leave."
"What do you think we should do?"
"Officially," Ebenezer said, "we follow the Merlin's lead. More than anything now, we need to stay together."
"What about unofficially?"
"Think about it," Ebenezer snorted.
If we just sit here, the vampires are going to take apart or drive away our allies, and then we'll have to take them all on alone. Look, Hoss, are you sure about this duel?
Hell no, I said. I just didn't see much choice. I'll figure out something. If I win, it might be worth it to the Council. Neutral territory for meeting and negotiating could come in handy.
Ebenezer sighed. Aye, the Merlin will think the same thing.
He was quiet for a moment before he said,
Not much like the days on the farm, is it, Hoss?
Not much, I agreed.
Do you remember that telescope we set up in the loft?
Ebenezer had taught me what I knew of astronomy. On long, dark summer evenings in the Ozark Hills, hay doors to the barn's loft open, stars overhead shining in the country darkness by the millions.
I remember. That asteroid we discovered that turned out to be an old Russian satellite. Asteroid Dresden was a better name than Cosmos 5. He chuckled and added as an afterthought. Do you remember whatever happened to that telescope and such? I kept meaning to ask you, but I never got around to it.
We packed it in that steamer trunk in the horse stall.
With the observation logs?
Yeah, I said.
Oh, that's right, Ebenezer said.
Obliged.
Sure.
Hoss, we'll agree to the duel if that's what you want, but be careful.
I don't plan to roll over and die, I said. But if something should happen to me...
I coughed.
Well, if it does, there are some papers in my lab. You'll know how to find them. Some people I'd like to make sure are protected.
Oh, of course, Ebenezer said.
But I'm likely to carry on cranky if I have to drive all the way up to Chicago twice in as many years.
Hate for that to happen.
Luck, Hoss.
Thanks.
I hung up the phone, rubbed tiredly at my eyes, and stomped back down to the lab. Ebenezer hadn't come out and said it, but the offer had been there. Behind the old man's talk of days gone by, he'd been offering me sanctuary at his farm. It wasn't that I didn't like Chicago, but the offer was a tempting one. After a couple of rough years slugging it out with various bad guys, a quiet year or two on the farm near Hog Hollow, Missouri, sounded tempting. Of course, the safety offered in that image was an illusion. Ebenezer's place was going to be as well protected as any wizard's on Earth, and the old man himself could be a terrible foe. But the Red Court of Vampires had a big network supporting it, and they didn't generally bother to play fair. They destroyed a wizard stronghold the previous summer, and if they'd cracked that place, they could do it to Ebenezer's Ozark hideaway, too. If I went there, and they found out about it, it would make the old man's farm too tempting a target to pass by. Ebenezer knew that as well as I did, but he and I shared a common trait. He doesn't like bullies, either. He'd be glad to have me, and he'd fight to the death against the Reds if they came, but I didn't want to draw that kind of thing down on him. I was grateful for the old man's support, but I owed him more than that. Besides, I was almost as well protected here in Chicago. My own wards, defensive screens of magic to protect my apartment, had kept me safe and alive for a couple of years, and the presence of a large, mortal population kept the vampires from trying anything completely overt. Wizards and vampires notwithstanding, everyone in the supernatural community knew damn well that plain old vanilla mortals were one of the most dangerous forces on the planet, and went out of their way not to become too noticeable to the population at large. The population at large, meanwhile, did everything it possibly could to keep from noticing the supernatural. So that worked out. The vampires had taken a poke or two at me since the war began, but it hadn't been anything I couldn't handle, and they didn't want to risk being any more obvious. Thus, Ortega and his challenge. So how the hell was I supposed to fight a duel with him without using magic? My bed called to me, but that thought was enough to keep me from answering. I paced around my living room for a while, trying to think of some kind of weapon that would give me the most advantage. Ortega was stronger, faster, more experienced, and more resistant to injury than me. How the hell was I supposed to pick a weapon to go up against that? I supposed if the duel could be worked into some kind of pizza-eating contest, I might have a shot. but somehow I didn't think that the Pizza Express Hungry Man Special was on the list of approved weaponry. I checked the clock and frowned. Dawn was only minutes away, and Bob wasn't back yet. Bob was a spirit being, a spirit of intellect from one of the more surreal corners of the Never Never. He wasn't evil as much as he was magnificently innocent of any kind of morality. But as a spirit, daylight was a threat to him, as surely as it was to the vampires of the Red Court. If he got caught out in it, it could kill him. Dawn was about 2 minutes off before Bob returned, flowing down the ladder and toward the skull. Something was wrong. Bob's manifestation of a candle-flame-colored cloud of swirling lights bobbed drunkenly left and right on its way back to the shelf with a skull. Purple globs of glowing plasm dribbled from the cloud in a steady trail, striking the floor, where they winked out into blobs of transparent goo. The cloud flowed into the skull, and after a moment, faint violet flames appeared in the skull's empty eye sockets. "Ow," Bob said, his voice tired. "Hell's bells," I muttered. "Bob, you all right?"
"No."
"Bob? Monosyllabic? Crap. Is there anything I can do to help?"
"No," Bob said faintly. "Rest."
"But..."
"Report," Bob said. "Have to."
Right. He'd been sent out on a mission, and he was feeling pressured to finish it. What happened?
"Wards,"
Bob said.
"Marcones."
I felt my mouth fall open.
"What?" "Wards,"
Bob repeated. I sat down on my stool. How the hell did Marcone get wards? Bob's tone became a shade contemptuous.
"Magic?"
The insult relieved me a little. If he was able to be a wise-ass, he'd probably be okay. "Could you tell me who did the wards?"
"No. Too good."
Damn. A spell had to get up pretty early in the morning to get around Bob. Maybe he'd been hurt worse than I thought. What about Ortega?
"Rothschild," Bob said. "Half a dozen vamps with him. Maybe a dozen mortals."
Bob's eye lights flickered and guttered. I couldn't risk losing Bob by pushing him too hard, and spirit or not, he wasn't immortal. He wasn't afraid of bullets or knives, but there were things that could kill him. "Good enough for now," I said. "Tell me the rest later. Get some sleep." Bob's eye lights flickered out without another word. I frowned at the skull for a while and then shook my head. I collected my potion bottles, cleaned up the work area, and turned to leave and let Bob get some rest. I was leaning over the ward flames to blow them out when the green candle hissed and shrank to a pinpoint of light. The yellow candle beside it flared up without warning, brighter than an incandescent light bulb. My heart started pounding, and nervous fear danced over the back of my neck. Something was approaching my apartment. That's what it meant when the flame spread from the green to the yellow candle. Warning spells I had threaded out to a couple of blocks from my house had sensed the approach of supernatural hostility. The yellow candle dimmed, and the red candle exploded into a flame the size of my head.
Stars and stones.
The intruder that had triggered the warning system the ward flames were linked to was getting closer, and it was something big. Or else a lot of somethings. They were heading in fast to set off the red candle so quickly, only a few dozen yards from my house. I dashed up the ladder from the lab and got ready to fight. Chapter 10. I got up the ladder in time to hear a car door shut outside my apartment. I'd lost my .357 during a battle between the ferry courts hosted on clouds over Lake Michigan the previous midsummer, so I'd moved my .44 from the office to home. It hung on a gun belt on a peg beside the door, just over a wire basket I'd attached to the wall. Holy water, a couple cloves of garlic, vials of salt, and iron filings filled the basket, intended to be door prizes for anything that showed up in an attempt to suck my blood, carry me off to fairyland, or sell me stale cookies. The door itself was reinforced steel and could stand up to punishment better than the wall around it. I'd had a demon come a-knocking before, and I didn't want an encore performance. I couldn't afford new furniture, even second-hand. I belted on the gun, shook out my shield bracelet, and took up my staff and blasting rod. Anything that came through my door would have to contend with my threshold, the aura of protective energy around any home. Most supernatural things didn't do so well with thresholds. After that, they'd have to force their way past my wards, barriers of geometrically aligned energy that would block out physical or magical intrusion, turning that energy back upon its source. A small, gentle push at my wards would result in a similar push against whatever was trying to get in. A swift or heavy push would result in more energy feeding back onto the attacker. Within the wards were sigils of fire and ice, which were designed to deliver bursts of destructive energy about as powerful as your average landmine. It was a solid and layered defense. With luck, it should be enough to stop a considerable amount of threat from even reaching my door. And since I'm such a lucky guy, I took a deep breath, pointed my blasting rod at the door, and waited. It didn't take long. I expected flashes of magical discharge, demon howls, maybe some kind of pyrotechnics as evil magic clashed against my own defensive spells. Instead, I got 7 polite knocks. I peered at the door suspiciously and then asked, "Who's there?" A low, rough man's voice growled, "The Archive." "What the hell?" "The Archive who?" Evidently, the speaker didn't have a sense of humor. "The Archive," the voice repeated firmly. "The Archive has been appointed emissary in this dispute, and is here to speak to Wizard Dresden about the duel." I frowned at the door. I vaguely remembered mention of an archive of some sort during the last White Council meeting I'd attended as a neutral party. At the time, I'd assumed it had been some sort of arcane library. I'd had other things on my mind at the time, and I hadn't been listening too closely.
"How do I know who you are?"
There was a rasp of paper on stone, and an envelope slid under my door, one corner poking out.
"Documentation, Wizard Dresden," the voice replied, "and a pledge to abide by the laws of hospitality during this visit."
Some of the tension left my shoulders, and I lowered the gun. That was one good thing about dealing with the supernatural community. If something gave you its word, you could trust it. Within reason. Then again, maybe that was just me. Of all the things I'd encountered, I'd been more of a weasel about keeping my word than any of them. Maybe that's why I was leery about trusting someone else. I picked up the envelope and unfolded a sheet of plain paper, certifying that its bearer had been approved by the White Council to act as emissary in the matter of the duel. I passed my hand over it and muttered a quick charm with the last password I'd gotten from the wardens, and in response, a brief glowing pentacle appeared, centered on the paper like a bioluminescent watermark. It was legit. I folded the paper closed again, but I didn't set my rod and staff aside just yet. I undid the deadbolt, muttered my wards back, and opened the door enough to see outside. A man stood on my doorstep. He was nearly as tall as me, but looked a lot more solid, with shoulders wide enough to make the loose black jacket he wore fit tightly on his upper arms. He wore a navy blue shirt and stood so that I could see the wrinkles caused by the straps of a shoulder rig. A black ball cap reined in dark golden hair that might have fallen to his shoulders. He hadn't shaved in a few days and had a short white scar below his mouth that highlighted the cleft in his chin. His eyes were gray-blue and empty of any expression in a way I had seldom seen. Not like he was hiding what he felt, more like there was simply nothing there.
"Dresden?" he asked.
"Yeah," I eyed him up and down. "You don't look very archive-esque." He lifted his eyebrows, a mildly interested expression.
"I'm Kincaid. You're wearing a gun."
"Only when company comes over."
"I haven't seen any of the council's people carrying a gun."
"Good for you." He turned and waved his hand. "This shouldn't take long." I glanced past him.
"Well, what do you mean?"
A second later, a little girl started down my stairs, one hand carefully on the guide rail. She was adorable, maybe 7 years old, her blonde hair still baby-fine and straight, clipped neatly at her shoulders and held back with a hairband. She wore a plain little corduroy dress with a white blouse and shiny black shoes, and her coat was a puffy, down-filled jacket that seemed like a bit of overkill for the weather. I looked from the kid to Kincaid and said, "You can't be bringing a child into this."
"Sure I can," Kincaid said.
"What, couldn't you find a babysitter?" The child stopped a couple of steps up so that her face was even with my own and said, her voice serious and marked with a faint British accent, "He is my babysitter." I felt my eyebrows shoot up. "Or more accurately, my driver," she said. "Are you going to let us in? I prefer not to remain outdoors." I stared at the kid for a second.
"Aren't you a little short for a librarian?"
"I am not a librarian," the child said. "I am the archive."
"Hang on a minute," I said.
"What do you—"
"I am the archive," the child said, her voice steady and assured. "I assume that your wards detected my presence. They seemed functional."
"You?" I said. "You've got to be kidding." I extended my senses gingerly toward her. The air around her fairly hummed with power, different from what I would expect around another wizard, but strong all the same, a quiet and dangerous buzz like that around high-tension power lines. I had to suppress a sudden rush of apprehension from showing on my face. The girl had power. She had a hell of a lot of power. Enough to make me wonder if my wards would be enough to stop her if she decided to come through them. Enough to make me think of little Billy Mummy as the omnipotent brat on that old episode of The Twilight Zone. She regarded me with implacable blue eyes I suddenly did not want to take the chance of looking into.
"I can explain it to you, wizard," she said, "but not out here. I have neither an interest nor an inclination to do you any harm. Perhaps the opposite."
I frowned at her.
"Promise?"
"Promise,"
the child said solemnly.
"Cross your heart and hope to die?"
She drew an X over her puffy jacket with one index finger.
"You don't know how much."
Kincaid took a couple of steps up and glanced warily around the street.
"Make up your mind, Dresden. I'm not keeping her out here for long."
"What about him?"
I asked the archive and nodded toward Kincaid. "Can he be trusted?"
"Kincaid?" the girl asked, her voice whimsical. "Can you be trusted?"
"You're paid up through April," the man replied, his eyes still scanning the street. "After that, I might get a better offer."
"There," the girl said to me. "Kincaid can be trusted until April. He's an ethical man, in his way."
She shivered and put her hands into the pockets of her puffy coat. She hunched up her shoulders and watched my face.
"Generally speaking, my instincts about people, who weren't women who might potentially end up doing adult things with me, were pretty good. I trusted the archive's promise. Besides, she was darling and looked like she was starting to get cold."
"Fine," I said. "Come inside."
I stepped back and opened the door. The archive came in and told Kincaid,
"Wait with the car. Come fetch me in 10 minutes.
Kincaid frowned at her and then me.
"You sure?"
"Quite."
The archive stepped in past me and started taking off her coat.
10 minutes. I want to head back before rush hour begins."
Kincaid fixed his empty eyes on me and said,
"Be nice to the little girl, wizard. I've handled your kind before." "I get more threats before 9 a.m. than most people get all day," I responded, and shut the door on him. Purely for effect, I locked it too.
Me? Petty? Surely not. I lit a couple of candles in order to get a little more light into the living room and stirred up the fire, adding more wood to it as soon as the embers were glowing. While I did, the archive took off her coat, folded it neatly over the arm of one of my lumpy, comfy chairs, and sat down, back straight, hands folded in her lap. Her little black shoes waved back and forth above the floor. I frowned at her. It's not like I don't like kids or anything, but I hadn't had much experience with them. Now, I had one sitting there wanting to talk to me about a duel. How the hell did a child, no matter how large her vocabulary, manage to get appointed an emissary?
So, what's your name?
She said, The Archive.
Yeah, I got that part. But I meant your name, what people call you.
The Archive, she repeated. I do not have a familiar name. I am the Archive, and have always been the Archive.
You're not human, I said.
Incorrect. I am a 7-year-old human child.
With no name? Everybody has a name, I said. I can't go around calling you the Archive.
The girl tilted her head to one side, arching a pale gold eyebrow. Then what would you call me?
Ivy, I said at once.
Why Ivy? She asked.
You're the Archive, right? Arch-ive. Arch-ivy.
Ivy. The girl pursed her lips. Ivy, she said, and then nodded slowly. Ivy. Very well. She regarded me for a moment and then said, Go ahead and ask the question, wizard. We might as well get it out of the way.
Who are you? I asked. Why are you called the Archive?
Ivy nodded. The thorough explanation is too complex to convey to you here, but in short, I am the living memory of mankind.
What do you mean, the living memory?
I am the sum of human knowledge, passed down from generation to generation, mother to daughter. Culture, science, philosophy, law, tradition. I hold the accumulated memories of 1,000 generations of mankind. I take in all that is written and spoken. I study. I learn. That is my purpose, to procure and preserve knowledge.
So you're saying that if it's been written down, you know it?
I know it. I understand it.
I sat down slowly on the couch and stared at her. Hell's bells. It was almost too much to comprehend. Knowledge is power, and if Ivy was telling me the truth, she knew more than anyone alive.
How did you get this gig? My mother passed it on to me, she replied, as I was born, just as she received it when she was born.
And your mother lets a mercenary drive you around?
Certainly not. My mother is dead, wizard. She frowned. Not dead, technically. But all that she knew and was came into me. She became an empty cup, a persistent vegetative state. Her eyes grew a little wistful, distant. She's free of it, but she certainly isn't alive, in the most vital sense. I'm sorry, I said. I wouldn't know why. I know my mother, and all before her. She put a finger to her temple. It's all in here.
You know how to use magic? I asked.
I prefer calculus.
But you can do it.
Yes.
Yikes. If the reaction of my wards was any indication, it meant that she was at least as strong as any member of the White Council. Probably stronger. But if that was true... If you know that much, I said, if you are that powerful, why did you hire a bodyguard to bring you here?
My feet don't reach the pedals.
I felt like smacking myself on the forehead. Oh, right. Ivy nodded.
In preparation for the duel, I will need some information, namely where I might contact your second, and what weapon you prefer for the duel.
I don't have a second yet. Ivy arched an eyebrow.
Then you have until sundown this evening to gain one. Otherwise the match and your life will be forfeit.
Forfeit? How would the forfeit be collected? The little girl stared at me for a silent moment. Then she said,
I'll do it.
I swallowed, a cold chill rippling over me. I believed her. I believed that she could. And I believed that she would. Okay. Look, I haven't exactly chosen a weapon yet, either. If I...
Simply choose one, Mr. Dresden. Will, skill, energy, or flesh?
Wait, I said. I thought I got to pick swords or guns or something. Ivy shook her head.
Read your copy of the Accords. I choose what is available, and I choose the ancient ways.
You may match wills with your opponent to gauge which of you is the most determined. You may match your skill at arms against his, each of you with weaponry of your individual choosing. You may wield energy forces against each other, or you may challenge him to unarmed combat. She considered. I would advise against the last.
Thanks, I muttered. I'll take magic. Energy.
You realize, of course, that he will decline in that venue, and you will be forced to choose another.
I sighed. Yeah, but until he does, I don't have to pick another one, right?
Indeed, Ivy acknowledged.
There was a knock on the door, and I got up to open it. Kincaid nodded to me, then leaned in and said, 10 minutes.
Thank you, Kincaid,
Ivy said. She rose, drew a business card from her pocket, and passed it to me.
Have your second call this number.
I took the card and nodded.
I will.
Just then, Mister emerged from my bedroom and lazily arched his back. Then he padded over to me and rubbed his shoulder against my shin by way of greeting.
Ivy blinked and looked down at Mister, and her child's face was suddenly suffused with a pure and uncomplicated joy. She said,
Kitty!
And immediately knelt down to pet Mister. Mister apparently liked her. He started purring louder and walked around Ivy, rubbing up against her while she petted him and spoke to him quietly. Hell's bells. It was adorable. She was just a kid. A kid who knew more than any mortal alive. A kid with a scary amount of magical power. A kid who would kill me if I didn't show up to the duel. But still a kid. I glanced up at Kincaid, who stood frowning down at Ivy, fawning all over Mister. He shook his head and muttered, Now that's just creepy.
Chapter 11 Ivy seemed reluctant to leave off petting Mister, but she and Kincaid left without further conversation. I shut the door after them and leaned on it, listening with my eyes closed until they'd gone. I didn't feel as tired as I should have, probably because I had a wealth of experience that suggested I would get a lot more worn out before I got a real chance to rest. Mister rubbed up against my legs until I leaned down to pet him, after which he promptly walked over to his food bowl, ignoring me altogether. I grabbed a Coke from the icebox while he ate, absently pouring a bit onto a saucer and leaving it on the floor by Mister. By the time I'd finished it, I'd made up my mind about what I had to do next. Make phone calls. I called the number Vincent had left for me first. I expected to reach an answering service, but to my surprise, Vincent's voice, tense and anxious, said,
Yes?
It's Harry Dresden, I said. I wanted to check in with you.
Ah, yes, just a moment,
Vincent said. I heard him say something, caught a bit of conversation in the background, and then heard him walking and a door shut behind him.
The police, he said. I've been working with them throughout the evening.
Any luck? I asked.
God only knows, Vincent said. But from my perspective, it seems the only thing accomplished is deciding which department is going to handle the investigation.
Homicide, I guessed.
Vincent's tired voice became dry.
Yes. Though the mind boggles at the chain of logic that led to it.
Election year. City management is politicking, I said. But once you start dealing with the actual police personnel, you should be all right. There are good people in every department.
One hopes. Have you found anything?
I've got a lead. I don't know how good. The thieves might be on a small craft in the harbor. I'm heading down there presently.
Very well, Vincent said.
If the lead is good, do you want me to call CPD?
I'd rather you contacted me first, Vincent said. I am still uncertain of how much trust to place in the local police. I cannot help but think it must have been the reason the thieves fled here, that they possessed some contact or advantage with the local authorities. I'd like as much time as possible to decide whom to trust.
I frowned and thought about Marcone's flunkies taking a shot at me. Chicago PD had an unfair reputation for corruption, thanks in part to the widespread mob activity during Prohibition. It was inaccurate, but people were people, and people aren't immune to being bought. Marcone had attained police-only information with
disturbing speed before.
Might be smart. I'll check it out and let you know. Shouldn't be more than an hour or two.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Dresden. Is there anything else?
Yeah, I said. I should have thought of this last night. Do you have any pieces of the shroud?
Pieces? Vincent asked.
Scraps or threads. I know that many samples were analyzed back in the 70s. Do you have access to any of those pieces?
Very possibly. Why?
I had to remind myself that Vincent seemed to be largely a non-believer in the supernatural, so I couldn't come out and say that I wanted to use thaumaturgy to track down the shroud. To confirm identification when I find it, I don't want to get foxed with a decoy.
Of course, I'll make a call, Vincent said. Get a sample FedExed here. Thank you, Mr. Dresden.
I said goodbye, hung up, and stared at the phone for a minute. Then I took a deep breath and dialed Michael's number. Even though the sky was barely light with morning, the phone rang only once before a woman's voice said, "Hello." This was my nightmare.
"Oh, hello, Charity. It's Harry Dresden."
"Hi," the voice said brightly. "This isn't Charity, though." So maybe it wasn't my nightmare. It was my nightmare's oldest daughter.
"Molly?" I asked. "Wow, you sound all grown up now."
She laughed.
"Yeah, the breast fairy came to visit and everything. Did you want to talk to my mom?"
Some might find it significant that it took me a second to realize she wasn't being literal about the fairy. Sometimes I hate my life.
"Well, is your dad around?"
"So you don't want to talk to Mom. Check," she said. "He's working on the addition. Let me get him." She set the phone down, and I heard footsteps walking away. In the background, I could hear recorded children's voices singing, the rattle of plates and forks, and people talking. Then there was a rustling sound and a thump as the handset on the other end must have fallen to the floor. Then I heard the sound of heavy, squishy breathing.
"Harry," sighed another voice from what must have been the same room.
She sounded much like Molly, but less cheerful.
"No, no, honey, don't play with the phone. Give that to me, please."
The phone rattled some more. The woman said,
"Thank you, sweetie."
And then she picked up the phone and said, "Hello? Anyone there?" For a second, I was tempted to remain silent or possibly try to imitate a recording of the operator, but I steeled myself against that. I didn't want to let myself get rattled. I was pretty sure that Charity could smell fear, even over the phone. It could trigger an attack.
"Hello, Charity. It's Harry Dresden. I was calling to speak to Michael."
There was a second of silence during which I couldn't help but imagine the way Michael's wife's eyes must have narrowed.
"I suppose it was inevitable," she said. "Naturally, if there is a situation so dangerous as to require all three of the knights, you come crawling out of whatever hole you live in."
"Actually, this is sort of unrelated."
"I assumed it was. Your idiocy tends to strike at the worst possible place and time."
"Oh, come on, Charity, that's not fair." Growing anger made her voice clearer and sharper, if no louder.
"No? At the one time in the last year that Michael most needs to be focused on his duty, to be alert and careful, you arrive to distract him."
Anger warred with guilt for dominance of my reaction.
"I'm trying to help."
"He has scars from the last time you helped, Mr. Dresden." I felt like slamming the receiver against the wall until it broke, but I restrained myself again. I couldn't stop the anger from making my words bite, though.
"You're never going to give me an inch, are you?"
"You don't deserve an inch," I said.
"Is that why you named your son after me?"
"That was Michael," Charity said. "I was still on drugs, and the paperwork was done when I woke up." I kept my voice calm, mostly.
"Look, Charity, I'm real sorry you feel the way you do, but I need to talk to Michael. Is he there or not?"
The line clicked as someone else picked up another extension, and Molly said,
"Sorry, Harry, but my dad isn't here. Sonia said he went out to pick up some donuts."
"Molly," Charity said, her voice hard, "it's a school day. Don't dawdle."
"Uh-oh,"
Molly said.
"I swear it's like she's telepathic or something."
I could almost hear Charity grinding her teeth.
"That isn't funny, Molly. Get off the line."
Molly sighed and said, "Surrender, Dorothy," before she hung up. I choked on a sudden laugh and tried to turn it into a series of coughs for Charity's benefit. From the tone of her voice, she hadn't been fooled.
"I'll give him a message."
I hesitated. Maybe I should ask to wait for him to return. There wasn't any love lost between Charity and myself, and if she didn't pass word along to Michael, or if she delayed before telling him, it could mean my death. Michael and the other knights were busy with their pursuit of the Shroud, and God only knew if I'd be able to get in touch with him again today. On the other hand, I had neither the time nor the attention to spare to sit there butting heads with Charity until Michael returned. Charity had been unreservedly hostile to me for as long as I'd known her. She loved her husband ferociously and feared for his safety, especially when he worked with me. In my head, I knew that her antagonism wasn't wholly without basis. Michael had been busted up several times when teamed up with me. During the last such outing, a bad guy gunning for me had nearly killed Charity and her unborn child, little Harry. Now she worried about the consequences that might be visited on her other children as well. I knew that, but it still hurt. I had to make a decision, to trust her or not. I decided to do it. Charity might not like me, but she was no coward and no liar. She knew Michael would want her to tell him.
"Well, Mr. Dresden," Charity asked,
"just let him know that I need to talk to him."
"Regarding?"
For a second, I debated passing Michael my tip on the Shroud. But Michael believed that I was going to get killed if I got involved. He took protecting his friends seriously, and if he knew that I was poking around, he might be inclined to knock me unconscious and lock me in a closet now and apologize later. I decided against it. "Tell him that I need a second by sundown tonight, or bad things will happen."
"To who?"
Charity asked. "Me." She paused, then said,
"I'll give him your message."
And then she hung up on me. I hung up the phone, frowning. "That pause wasn't significant," I told Mister. "It doesn't mean that she was chewing over the thought of intentionally getting me killed in order to protect her husband and children." Mister regarded me with that mystic distance focus in his feline eyes. Or maybe that was the look he got when his brain waves flatlined. Either way, it was neither helpful nor reassuring. "I'm not worried," I said. "Not one bit." Mister's tail twitched. I shook my head, got my stuff together, and headed out to investigate the lead at the harbor.
Chapter 12.
When I first came to Chicago, I thought of a harbor as a giant bowl of ocean, with ships and boats in the foreground, and the faded outline of the buildings on the far side in the background. I had always imagined political subversives dressed up as tribal natives and a huge hit in the profit margin of the East India Company. Burnham Harbor looked like the parking lot of an ocean-going Walmart. It might have been able to hold a football field or three. White wharves stretched out over the water with pleasure boats and small fishing vessels in rows within the placid oval of water. The scent of the lake was one part dead fish, one part algae-coated rock, and one part motor oil. I parked in a lot up the hill from the harbor, got out, and made sure I had my equipment with me. I wore my force ring on my right hand and my shield bracelet on my left wrist, and my blasting rod thumped against my leg where I had tied it to the inside of my leather duster. I'd added a can of self-defense spray to my arsenal, and I slipped it into my pants pocket. I would rather have had my gun, but toting it around in my pocket was a felony. The pepper spray wasn't. I locked up the car and felt a sudden slithering pressure on my back, my instinct's way of screaming that someone was watching me. I kept my head down, my hands in my pockets, and walked toward the harbor. I didn't rubberneck around, but I tried to get a look at everything while moving only my eyes. I didn't see anyone, but I couldn't shake the impression that I was being observed. I doubted it was anyone from the Red Court. The morning hadn't reached full brightness yet, but it was still light enough to parboil a vampire. That didn't rule out any number of other flavors of assassin, though, and it was possible that if the thieves were here, they were keeping an eye on everyone coming and going.
All I could do was walk, steadily, and hope that whoever was watching me wasn't one of Marcone's thugs, a vampire groupie or a rent-a-gun aiming a rifle at my back from several hundred yards away. I found the étranger in a few minutes, moored at a slip not far from the entrance. It was a pretty little ship, a white pleasure boat roomy enough to house a comfortable cabin. The étranger wasn't new, but she looked neat and well cared for. A Canadian flag hung from a little stand on the ship's after deck. I moved on past the ship at a steady pace and listened as I did. Listening is a trick I'd picked up when I was a kid. Not many people have worked out the trick of it, blocking out all other sound in order to better hear one sound in particular, such as distant voices. It isn't as much about magic, I think, as it is focus and discipline. But the magic helps.
"Unacceptable," said a quiet female voice in the étranger's cabin. It was marked with a gentle accent, both Spanish and British. "The job entailed a great deal more expense than was originally estimated. I'm raising the price to reflect this, nothing more."
There was a short pause, and then the woman said,
"Would you like an invoice for your tax return, then? I told you the quote was only an estimate. It happens."
Another pause, and then the woman said,
"Excellent. As scheduled, then."
I stared out at the lake, just taking in the view, and strained to hear anything else. Evidently, the conversation was over. I checked around, but there weren't any people in sight moving around the harbor on a February weekday morning. I took a breath to steady myself and moved closer to the ship. I caught a glimpse of motion through a window in the cabin and heard a chirping sound. A cell phone rested on a counter beside a pad of hotel stationery. A woman appeared in the window dressed in a long gown of dark silk and picked up the cell phone. She answered it without speaking and a moment later said,
"I'm sorry, you've the wrong number."
I watched as she put the phone down and casually let the nightgown slide to the floor. I watched a little more. I wasn't being a peeping Tom. This was professional. I noted that she had some intriguing curves. See? Professionalism in action. She opened a door, and a bit of steam wafted out, the sound of the water growing louder. She stepped in and closed the door again, leaving the cabin empty. I had an opportunity. I'd seen only one woman, and not well enough to positively identify her as either Anna Valmont or Francisca Garcia, the two remaining church mice. I hadn't seen the shroud hanging from a laundry line or anything. Even so, I had the feeling I'd come to the right place. My gut told me to trust my spiritual informer. I made my decision and stepped up a short gangplank onto the étranger. I had to move fast. The woman on the ship might not be a fan of long showers. All I needed to do was get inside, see if I could find anything that might verify the presence of the shroud, and get out again. If I moved quickly enough, I could get in and out without anyone the wiser. I went down the stairs to the cabin with as much stealth as I could manage. The stairs didn't creak. I had to duck my head a bit when I stepped into the cabin. I stayed close to the door and checked around, listening to the patter of the water from the shower. The room wasn't large and didn't offer a bonanza of places to hide. A double bed took up nearly a quarter of the space in the room. A tiny washing machine and dryer were stacked one on another in a corner, a basket of laundry stowed atop them. A counter and kitchenette with a couple of small refrigerators used up most of the rest. I frowned. Two fridges? I checked them out. The first was stocked with perishables and beer. The second was a fake and opened onto a cabinet containing a heavy metal strongbox. Bingo. The shower kept running. I reached out to pick up the strongbox, but a thought struck me. The church mice may have gotten themselves into a lot of trouble, but they'd evidently been good enough to avoid Interpol for a number of years. The hiding place for the strongbox was too clumsy, too obvious. I shut the fake fridge and looked around the room. I was starting to get nervous. I couldn't have much time left to find the shroud and get out. Of course. I took a couple of long steps to the washer and dryer and grabbed the laundry basket. I found it under several clean, fluffy towels, an opaque plastic package, a little larger than a folded shirt. I touched it with my left hand. A tingling sensation pulsed against my palm, and the hairs along my arm rose up straight. "Damn, I'm good," I muttered. I picked up the shroud and turned to go. A woman stood behind me, dressed in black fatigue pants, a heavy jacket, and battered combat boots. Her peroxide blonde hair was cut very short, but it did nothing to detract from the appeal of her features. She was elegantly pretty and pleasant to look at. The gun she had pointed at my nose wasn't pretty, though. It was an ugly old .38 revolver, a cheap Saturday night special. I was careful not to move. Even a cheap gun can kill you, and I doubted I could raise a shield in time to do me any good. She'd taken me off guard. I never heard her coming, never sensed her presence.
"Damn, I'm good," the woman echoed, her accent high British, a touch of amusement in her voice. "Put the package down."
I held it out to her. "Here." I wouldn't have tried for the gun, but if she stepped closer to me, it might show that she was an amateur. She wasn't, and remained standing out of grab range.
"On the counter, if you please."
"What if I don't?" I said. She smiled without humor.
"In that case, I'll have a dreary day of chores dismembering the body and cleaning up the blood. I'll leave it up to you."
I put the package on the counter. "Far be it from me to inconvenience a lady."
"What a dear boy you are," she said. "That's a very nice coat. Take it off, slowly, if you please."
I slipped out of the coat and let it fall to the floor.
"You tricked me onto the boat," I said. "That second phone call was you, telling your partner to draw me in."
"The shocking thing is that you fell for it," the woman said.
She kept giving directions, and she knew what she was doing. I leaned forward and put my hands against the wall while she patted me down. She found the pepper spray and took it, along with my wallet. She made me sit down on the floor on my hands while she took my coat and stepped back.
"A stick," she said, looking at my blasting rod. "How very pre-Neolithic of you."
Uh-huh. A professional she might be, but she was a straight. She didn't believe in the supernatural. I wasn't sure if that was going to help or hurt. It might mean that she would be a little less eager to shoot me. People who know what a wizard can do get really nervous if they think the wizard is about to try a spell. On the other hand, it meant that I didn't have either the support of the rest of the council or the threat of my own retribution to use as leverage. I decided it was best to act like a normal for the time being. The blonde laid my coat on the counter and said, "Clear." The door to the bathroom opened, and the woman I'd heard before came out. She now wore a knit fabric dress, the color of dark wine, and a couple of combs held her hair back from her face. She wouldn't stand out in a crowd, but she wasn't unattractive.
"He's not Gaston," she said, frowning at me. "No," said the blonde. "He was here for the merchandise. He was just about to leave with it."
The dark-haired woman nodded and asked me,
"Who are you?"
"Dresden," I said. "I'm a private investigator, Ms. Garcia." Francisca Garcia's features froze, and she traded a look with the gun-wielding blonde.
"How did you know my name?"
"My client told me you and Ms. Valmont could be in a lot of trouble." Anna Valmont kicked the wall and spat, "Bollocks!" She glared at me, gun steady on me, despite her outburst.
"Are you working with Interpol?"
"Rome." Anna looked at Francisca and said, "We should scrub this sail. It's falling apart."
"Not yet," Francisca said. "There's no point in waiting."
"I'm not leaving yet," the dark-haired woman said, her eyes hard.
"Not until he gets here."
"He isn't coming," Anna said. "You know he isn't."
"Who?"
I asked. Francisca said, "Gaston." I didn't say anything. Evidently, Francisca could read faces well enough that I didn't have to. She stared at me for a moment and then closed her eyes, the blood draining from her face.
"Oh, oh, Dio."
"How?" Anna said. The gun never wavered.
"How did it happen?"
"Murder," I said quietly. "And someone set it up to point the police at Chicago."
"Who would have done that?"
"Some bad people after the shroud. Killers."
"Terrorists?"
"Not that playful," I said. "As long as you have the shroud, your lives are in danger. If you come with me, I can get you to some people who will protect you."
Francisca shook her head and blinked her eyes a couple of times.
You mean the police?
I meant the Knights, but I knew darn well what their stance would be on what to do with the thieves once any supernatural peril was past.
Yeah.
Anna swallowed and looked at her partner. Something around her eyes softened with concern, with sympathy. The two of them weren't solely partners in crime. They were friends. Anna's voice softened as she said,
Seska, we have to move. If this one found us, others may not be far behind.
The dark-haired woman nodded, her eyes not focused on anything.
Yes, I'll get ready.
She rose and stepped across the cabin to the washing machine. She drew out a pair of gym bags and put them on the counter over the package. Then she slipped into some shoes. Anna watched for a moment and then said to me,
Now, we can't have you running to the police to tell them everything. I wonder what to do with you, Mr. Dresden. It really does make a great deal of sense to kill you.
Messy, remember? You'd have that dreary day, I pointed out. That got a bit of a smile from her.
Ah, yes, I'd forgotten.
She reached into her pocket and drew out a pair of steel handcuffs. They were police quality, not the naughty fun kind. She tossed them to me underhand. I caught them.
Put one on your wrist, she said.
I did.
There's a ring on that bulkhead. Put the other through it and lock the cuffs.
I hesitated, watching Francisca slip into a coat, her expression still blank. I licked my lips and said,
You don't know how much danger you two are in, Miss Valmont.
You really don't. Please, let me help you.
I think not. We're professionals, Mr. Dresden. Thieves we might be, but we do have a work ethic.
You didn't see what they did to Gaston Laroche, I said. How bad it was.
When isn't death bad? The bulkhead, Mr. Dresden.
But Anna lifted the gun. I grimaced and lifted the cuffs to a steel ring protruding from the wall beside the stairs. As a result, I was looking up them to the ship's deck when the second denarian in 12 hours came hurtling down the stairway, straight toward me. Chapter 13. I only saw it coming out of the corner of my eye, and I barely had time to register the movement and lunge as far as I could to one side. The demon went by me in a blur of rustling metallic whispers, carrying the scent of lake water and dried blood. Neither of the church mice screamed, though whether this was intention or a byproduct of surprise, I couldn't tell. The demon was more or less human, generally speaking, and disturbingly female. The lines of curvy hips swept down to legs that were oddly hinged, back-jointed, like a lion's. She had skin of metallic green scales, and her arms ended in four-fingered, metallic clawed hands. Like the demon form of Ursule, she had two sets of eyes, one luminescent green, one glowing cherry red, and a luminous sigil burned at the center of her forehead. Her hair was long. I mean like 15 feet long, and looked like the demented love child of Medusa and Dr. Octopus. It had seemingly been cut in 1-inch strips from 1/2 mile of sheet metal. It writhed around her like a cloud of living serpents, metallic strands thrusting into the walls and the floor of the ship, supporting her weight like 12 additional limbs. Anna recovered from the surprise first. She already had a gun out and ready, but she hadn't been trained in how to use it in real combat. She pointed the gun more or less at the Denarian and emptied it at her in the space of a panicked breath. Since I was a couple of feet behind the demon, I flopped to one side as best I could, stayed low, and prayed to avoid becoming collateral damage. The demon flinched once, maybe taking a hit, before it shrieked and twisted its shoulders and neck. 12 metallic ribbons of writhing hair lashed across the room. One of them hit the gun itself, and metal shrieked as the demon tendril slashed clean through the gun's barrel. 6 more whipped toward Anna's face, but the blonde thief had reflexes fast enough to get her mostly out of the way. A tendril wrapped around Anna's ankle, jerked, and sent the woman sprawling to the floor, while another lashed across her belly like a scalpel, cutting through her jacket and sprinkling the cabin with fine drops of blood. Francisca stared at the thing for a second, her eyes huge and surrounded by white. Then she jerked open a drawer in the tiny galley, pulled out a heavy cutting knife, and lunged at the Denarian, blade flickering. It bit into the demon's arm and drew a furious shriek that did not sound at all human from her throat. The Denarian spun, silvery blood glistening on her scaly skin, and ripped one claw in a sweeping arch. The demon's claws sliced into Francisca's forearm, drawing blood. The knife tumbled to the ground. Francisca cried out and reeled back into one of the walls. The Denarian